Welcome to Faith Football Friends. I'm Chris Elrod, here with
Forrest Animaceris
and Chris Kidwell.
Chris Kidwell is subbing in, and he's our guest. Cole had some business to attend to. Not really sure exactly what's going on. There seems to be a woman stuck in his driveway, and her trailer has rolled down a hill, which is kind of a big deal there in, where is he at? Smithville, Tennessee?
Yeah, Smithville.
It'll probably be on the local news there, but
it's not true.
but it is what it is.
Forrest, you're from Florida and think you can just hate on every small town in Tennessee, which is not true.
No, you're right. I'm gonna get some blowback from that eventually. But definitely glad to have Chris Kidwell on the show. Chris, before we get into things, how about you tell us about yourself? It'd be a lot more interesting if you did it than if either one of us did it. You know, just basic biographical information. Let the people know what you're about, where you work, family stuff, worst fears, stuff like that.
Okay.
Can we do something first, though? For the rest of this show, I'll just go by Elrod. It's pretty much okay. All I was called in high school, and it'll just be easier that way. Because I was confused, and I was like, why do you want me to do this? But now I understand. So
there we have it. We'll have Elrod, that. And I guess if Christopher Elrod's going by Elrod, Chris Kidwell can just be Chris. That's what we'll do.
As I say, I think that was implicit in what he was saying there.
I wasn't smart enough to pick that up. I really wasn't.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you.
You're welcome, Elrod. I'm Chris Kidwell. I've been preaching now for about 7.5 years or so. Got my undergrad degree from Freed Hardeman in 2013 in music. And then graduated with my Master of Divinity in 2018, and have been putting off going to a doctoral program ever since. Been married to the former Kelsey Hackworth since June of 2012. I actually got offered my first ministry job the second night of our honeymoon, and so those things have been going on about the same amount of time.
That's awesome.
Stan Mitchell called me and said, sorry to bother you on your honeymoon, but we'd like to offer you a job. And I said, you don't need to apologize. And so that was fun because I didn't know how we were going to pay for things once we got to the end of that summer.
Wow.
And then Kelsey and I have two sons, Shiloh, who is 3, turned 3 on Thanksgiving Day last year, and then Shepherd, who just turned 2 a month ago yesterday. And so we don't sleep a lot, but that's okay. We love our boys and, just blessed by them. And then I've preached for the congregation in Fanger, Tennessee as their associate intern or whatever the technical term that they used at the time to describe that position was. I spent a couple of years from 2014 to 2016 at the Hera, Oklahoma congregation. And I've been at the Bridge Creek Church of Christ in Blanchard, Oklahoma, since late summer of 2016. And that's where we are now. Love being here and, enjoy the work and got a congregation we love to work with.
Awesome. Awesome. That's really cool. I don't know how I'd feel getting called on my honeymoon, man. You were really gracious about that. I'm honestly kind of impressed.
If it would have been most anyone else, I might have been offended, but I was rarely offended when Stan called for any reason whatsoever. And when someone calls and offers you a job when you don't really have things lined up, like I had work lined up through the end of that summer working grounds at Freed Hardeman, and then after that, the work was going to disappear. And while rent wasn't super high where we were at, it's a whole bunch if you don't have any income. And so I was thrilled to get a call about that position and thrilled to get started. About a month after I got the call is when we started. So,
okay. Awesome.
That's awesome.
So Chris, you're going to talk to us today about a book that is the author's name, John, what's his name?
John Goldingay.
Okay, John Goldingay, and it's Old Testament Ethics. What's the subtitle?
A Guided Tour.
A Guided Tour of Old Testament Ethics. That sounds extremely exciting. But so just for transparency's sake, this book was provided to us by IVP, not for a positive review, but just for an honest review. And we've outsourced that to the very talented Chris Kidwell, who's with us today to tell us about that book. So before we grill you over it, give us like a really, not really super brief, but like a 5 minute or so, just like Spark Notes version of Mr. Golden Gay's argument and support in Old Testament ethics.
Okay. So Golden Gay, in the introduction, he lays it out that sometimes when we consider Old Testament ethics, we consider it on our own terms. We either look at how the Old Testament applies directly into our life today, how it addresses our own issues, or we look at problems that we have with the Old Testament, and we try and, in his words, try and get the Old Testament, get God off the hook, as it were. You know, why would God command this? Why would God command that? And either try and justify the issue in a complicated way or sort of sidestep the issue altogether. His main point that he's trying to do is he's trying to let the Old Testament speak for itself. He's trying to let the Old Testament define ethics on its own terms. That is, it brings up its own issues and then it addresses them how God sees fit. God brings up these issues, the writers bring up these issues, and they address them how they see fit. And so for us to sort of read our own problems into the text becomes problematic. That being said, he does make a point of saying, you know, there are things that we can glean from the text. There are things that we can glean from a study of Old Testament ethics. Jesus did, after all, come in part to fulfill the law. And so, but he doesn't focus so much on that. It's not so much a focus on here's everything the Old Testament says about sex and here's what it means for you. Here's everything the Old Testament says about, you know, loving your neighbor and here's what it means for you. It's just, here's what the Old Testament says about these things. And here are some very, very general principles we might be able to take from the text. So that's sort of his main thesis. The closest, there's not really a dedicated point that he's trying to prove beyond that. He's not trying to make a definitive statement on any sort of controversial issue or anything like that. He just wants the text to be able to speak for itself. There are five sections of the book. Qualities is the first one. Aspects of life is the second. Relationships is the third. Texts is the fourth. And people is the fifth. The first three of these read really like glorified concordances. He will just throw up a ton of scripture at you. Here's what the Old Testament says about this issue. So like within Qualities, the very first chapter is godlikeness. And here's everything the Old Testament has to say about being like God, which is helpful. But in many of these chapters, especially in the first three sections, he doesn't really go into as much detail. He doesn't go as in depth in some of these things as I wish he would have done. It's really just here's what it says and here's a couple of things we can draw from it. But like I said, it's at that point just a glorified concordance in a lot of ways. The fourth section, the texts, what he'll do is he takes maybe one particular issue and one particular text that addresses that issue. And so he takes the Book of Ruth for commitment, for example. He takes Song of Songs for sex, for example, and he'll draw out some of the principles laid forth in those texts. And then he'll use other texts in the Old Testament, namely wisdom literature, to show how those things are meant to be lived out practically. It's that particular section, the fourth section, that intertextual work he does is really quite good, is really quite helpful, and I'll elaborate on that a little bit later. And then finally, in part five, people, he lists a bunch of examples of people, you know, Abraham and some of his ethical dilemmas, Sarah and some of his ethical dilemmas, Shipra and Pua in Exodus chapter 1 and some of their ethical dilemmas, and basically says, here's what the text says about it, and kind of leaves it up to us to draw our own conclusions in a lot of different ways. And so that's largely what he does. I think the strongest point that he makes, and he makes it a few times throughout the book, is to let the Old Testament speak on its own terms, and in doing so, realize that there is a reason. It's some of these laws that we think are kind of offbeat. They're not arbitrary. One that gets brought up a few different times in the book is the command in Exodus chapter 23 for the Israelites to not boil a kid in its mother's milk. And that's thrown in there right in the middle of the chapter, just almost seemingly randomly upon a cursory glance. But one of the points he draws from that I think is really emblematic of the book at its best, is the idea that, boiling the kid in its mother's milk is sort of a perversion of life and death, that the milk is supposed to, is meant to give life. Whereas if we were to boil a kid in its mother's milk, that would be using what is meant to give life to take life at that point. And that's really emblematic of probably the biggest strength of the book, is really just this consideration of, God commanded these things. God commanded these specific commands. Why? They're not arbitrary. There's reason behind them, and there's reason, at least in a lot of cases, that we're able to understand.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I always I remember reading that verse. This is no joke. Coincidentally, I remember reading that verse for the first time in preaching school, and that night I had dinner at Chick-fil-A. And they were advertising a new, I think it was new at the time, breakfast sandwich that was a chicken patty topped with a scrambled egg. And for some reason, my mind made a connection to boiling a kid in the mother's milk. I was like, you can't eat chicken and eggs together, man. That's kind of gross. I don't know if there's any actual connection there, but I remember, like, every time I read that now, that's what I think about.
Right.
I was getting chicken and eggs at Cracker Barrel with, like, we were going there for breakfast some over the summer with the youth group, and, like, they started making fun of me for eating chicken and eggs. And so I had to stop doing it. I couldn't do it anymore.
Sorry. Yeah, it's almost like the more you think about it, the weirder it is. But and I don't want to cut you off, Chris, but I think this is important for us to say real quick before we go any further. If somebody's listening to this podcast and they're kind of like, they're not a preacher, they're not a Bible class teacher, they're not going to any kind of theological training or anything like that. What is this book on Old Testament ethics? Like, why should they care, I guess? What's in it for them?
To start with sort of the negative part, having a glorified concordance is not the worst thing in the world. Being able to point to one or two books that have – I want to look up sexual ethics. There's actually a chapter in here. I'm going to open the text just so I don't get this wrong. Chapter 22 is entitled Who You Can't Have Sex With. There's if you just want to be able to open up a book, read everything the Old Testament says about a particular subject, and read a little bit of commentary on it, some fairly light commentary at best on a lot of these subjects, it's actually a really good book for that. Granted, that's not what my expectation was going into it, and so I was a little disappointed. But for those who maybe aren't familiar with a lot of these passages, if you're listening and you'd never heard of that passage in Exodus chapter 23, or maybe you've not heard of what the Old Testament says about some of these other issues that are brought up, it's really good for that. And as I said before, the strongest point the book makes is just considering why God commands these things. Sometimes people, I think especially who are, just if we can say regular lay church members, however you want to put that, I don't know what the proper nomenclature is, but we'll look at some of these Old Testament commands and wonder, why would God have them do that? Maybe it's not the really out there commands. Maybe it's got to do with kosher food laws. Maybe it's got to do with sexuality. Maybe it's got to do with money and ethics involving cash flow. Why would God have his people act this particular way? The book does at times a good job of explaining those things. And again, the intertextuality showing here's what God commands, at least in a few cases, here's what God commands, and here's how that's meant to be lived out in your day-to-day life. And here's what can happen if you follow those commands, in drawing heavily from Proverbs. Here's what happens if you follow those commands, and here's what you can expect if you don't follow those commands. That's probably what it brings to the table for most people, is just, you know, reasoning about why the laws were laws, why the laws were given in the first place.
Yeah, that's good. I think a lot of times it's hard, and I think this might be, to borrow some language from, I can't remember the authors of the book, but Chris, you remember in Biblical Interpretation with Doug, I don't know if you,
Grasping God's
Elrod.
Word.
Elrod. Yeah, Grasping God's Word. Did you read that, Chris?
I don't remember reading it, no.
And there's this whole idea of like the cultural bridge and stuff, you know what I mean? Like trying to...
Right.
I feel like that's one of those issues where, because of the distance between us and the recipients of a lot of the Old Testament laws, they just seem completely arbitrary to us.
Absolutely.
So I think it's nice to kind of be like, oh, wait, look. And I don't know if, does he do, like, is that kind of how he solves that problem, by kind of looking at what's going on? Or is it more like these overarching principles?
He doesn't, probably my biggest criticism of the book, outside of the disappointing, you know, expectations with the glorified concordances, he doesn't quite finish that bridge. Or at times when he does, it's inconsistent. And so, you know, he'll talk about all these passages that talk about sexuality. And he spends a good deal of time talking about sexuality, because the Old Testament law spends a good deal of time talking about sexual ethics.
Yeah, for sure.
And then later on, he'll, you know, in discussing an application of those things, he'll talk about putting, you know, one anecdotal example of his congregation voting on whether or not they would allow homosexual marriages to take place inside their building. And saying that that's how we came away with that.
Wow.
Another way he does it is he'll talk about women. There's a chapter devoted entirely to ethical responsibilities regarding women, especially in possession and leadership roles and things like that. And he takes what is probably a very obscure example to people, the five daughters of Zelophehad, I think it is, from Numbers chapter 5. This is this guy that owns land, and he dies, and there are five daughters. Basically, under the law up to that point, they would have had no claim to the land. They petition Moses. Moses petitions God, and they're allowed to keep the land, basically, as long as they don't marry outside of the family. It is a very, very condensed way of summing up about a chapter or two's worth of material. But while he doesn't ever make it explicit, he sort of draws from that, you know, maybe we ought to be allowing women to do more than they are in our own services. And he goes, in my opinion, way beyond the scope of the text in doing that. Mm-hmm. And so it's fairly inconsistent, whereas in one case he'll draw, well, maybe there's a little bit of a guiding principle there from just a cacophony of evidence talking about homosexuality in the Old Testament. Right. And then in another instance, he brings up a very, very obscure example to really set a precedent for even today. When the book is at its best is when it's not trying to draw specific applications into our lives and really just set those, like you said, those general principles.
Okay. So if you're looking for maybe like a big picture view of where does the Bible and the Old Testament talk about these things, this is a book that'll help us do that.
I think it will. It really just in a general sense, that's right. You know, and in a practical sense, it can still do that, just not in a specific sense. If you practice these things, if you go against the law in this way, he'll draw once again from Proverbs largely. Here's what you can expect. But when he gets specific and when he tries to bridge that gap too much, the book kind of falls flat on its face in that particular arena.
It seems like almost he kind of claims to let the text just talk for itself, but then that he doesn't actually do that consistently.
Not consistently. By and large, once you get out of the first couple of sections of the book, he's a lot better about doing it. But that it'll still come up from time to time that, you know, he'll bring up a specific example and apply it. And sometimes I agree with him. I'm not suggesting that all the conclusions he comes to are disagreeable by any stretch. He's got a lot to say about adultery ruining marriages, just absolutely destroying marriages. I'm on board with that. I'm on the same page with him there. But in some particular instances, and those were the two most notable ones because of how far apart they were in how they were applied, in some instances, he can be a little all over the place.
Is there anything about the book really that you feel like needs to be said that hasn't been said already?
I would say that the book, I think, at least partially wants to be used in a classroom setting. The chapters are short, and there are discussion questions at the end of each chapter, like you would expect in maybe a 13 or 26 week type book meant to be used in a classroom. I would absolutely not use it for that. For one, some of the concepts that are discussed here are going to have very little application to the church membership at large. For two, the discussion questions are just awful, and that's relative to discussion questions being awful in most books in general. These are particularly bad. And so I think this is a fine reference material, for a Christian looking to figure out what the Old Testament says on a number of different issues and maybe have something a little bit more helpful than a Google search or even just the concordance in the back of your Bible. I think it can be helpful for preachers and theology students in having a little bit of commentary on that and also having something that maybe challenges us on some particular issues. The fact that I disagree with certain things he states, of course, talking about women and sort of the wishy-washy way he talked about homosexuality being things we've already discussed. But being challenged by those things isn't the worst thing in the world. Just because I disagree with his position doesn't necessarily make it a bad book on that particular point. And so having it as a sort of reference material, I think, can be quite helpful. But as far as a classroom environment, I don't see it being particularly helpful. And this is a guided tour, as it says in sort of the subtitle here. The tour guide doesn't go too in depth with the attractions, if you want to run with the metaphor there. It's not as deep and it's not as helpful as I would like it to be. There are good points for it, but it's not the first book that's coming off my shelf to give to someone if they've got a question about ethics.
Okay, well, good to know. And sometimes it is, beneficial to read things where, we know we're not going to necessarily come to the same conclusions as the author, just to sort of challenge our own, whether it's presuppositions or our own positions, and try to get to understand a little bit better what the other side's saying. So I appreciate that. And I think even, sometimes I have books that maybe aren't glorified concordances, but reference a lot of scripture. Right. And a lot of times that can be almost like a launching pad to me doing my own study on something, which can be really beneficial,
And it's good for that. I mean, if you can say anything about the book, it certainly does rely on scripture. You're going to be inundated with everything the Old Testament says about a particular issue. He does not shy away from things. There are entire pages of the book that are just quotations of scripture.
Wow.
it's a lot, which sounds good on the surface, and I appreciate that approach. But at the same time, when your chapters are four pages long,
right,
you do become a glorified concordance if one or two of your four-page chapters are that.
It hurts readability. In my opinion, it seems like to me that would make it really hard for me to read and enjoy the book just because it's like, okay, well, am I like, do I need to go and read every single one of these now to continue in this discussion and understanding of what the book's trying to say? Or, You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. It seems definitely more as a resource rather than a book to teach or even just a book to read and to grow from.
Well, and I think it depends on the scripture that's being used. When it comes to a narrative, I want that in front of me. Like, you know, we talked about the daughters of Zelophehad, which I'm sure someone's going to come and correct me on pronunciation there. But out of Numbers, I want that in front of me. Like, I want to be able to have the passage in front of me and then read what he's drawing from it. But when he's machine gunning 10 separate passages from Proverbs, all of a sudden it really, really bogs down the reading, because, I mean, he's not handpicking passages because he's doing a good job of getting everything in the Proverbs on a particular subject. But, you know, it's jarring to go from passage to passage to passage to passage. If it's, you know, if that page is just one long passage, oh, okay, I'm there with you. But when it's jumping around a bit, that can be problematic. I also think before we move on, I also think it's worth pointing out Golden Gay he's a fairly well-known author. That's part of the reason I was a little disappointed with the book, to be honest. He's a fairly well-known Old Testament writer, or one who writes about the Old Testament. Let's be clear there. But he was actually Logos Bible Software's featured author of the month of February. And so if you're listening
February?
To this,
this past February,
that's right. This past February,
wow.
you could have actually bought this book, like 40% off through Logos, well as several others he wrote.
Not a sponsor, but that might be a good way to do it. 'Cause then you got all the hyperlinks. You don't have to, you know, be flipping through your Bible as much.
That's true.
Yeah. I'm a big Logos software user. I think my library is up somewhere in the 3,000s or so.
Wow.
Materials. It's yeah.
Send me your username and your password sometime. That'd be fantastic.
Yeah, we'll talk.
Okay.
We'll talk. So, but no, I mean, Sam's the guy you got to talk to for that. He's
Sam Glover, definitely. Yeah, Sam. I might hit him up.
Okay, real fast. You said that this wouldn't be the first book that you would pull off your shelf to hand to someone with an ethics. That was asking about ethics. So I'm just curious, do you have a book in mind that would be the first book you would pull off your shelf? Or
I really, for just a concise breakdown of ethics, and I realize that this is Old Testament ethics focused, and so it's a little more niche than what I'll suggest. But if I'm going to suggest one singular book on ethics, I'm probably going to suggest Christian Ethics by Norman Geisler. He does an excellent job of breaking down some very practical issues, practical ethical issues that the vast majority of us, if we don't face them in our day-to-day lives, then it's at least reasonable that we could face them at some point. It's fairly short. It's readable. You know, when he explains his reasoning behind a tough decision, he does so in a way that makes sense, that's understandable. That's probably the first one I'm pulling off the shelf. And then if there's a specific ethical issue beyond that, that someone needs addressing, then it just depends on what that issue is.
Awesome.
Yeah, fair enough. That's great.
We'll put a link to Norman Geisler's book in the show notes, as well as Old Testament Ethics, A Guided Tour by John Golden Gay. Chris, we want to thank you for reading that book and talking to us about it. And I guess we'll take a little bit of a break for the listeners, and then we're going to talk about some sports. So we hope you stick around, purchase this book if it interests you. If not, just re-listen to the podcast and feel like you've read it.
All right, it is time to talk a little sports here with Mr. Chris Kidwell. He's a big hockey fan, and he's going to, I think, talk a little bit about what's going on in the hockey world and why we should be into hockey.
Well, so if I were to give my elevator pitch for hockey,
There you go.
I guess it would look something like this or sound something like this. You're not looking at this podcast, probably. Maybe. Anyway, it's the fastest and most physical team sport on Earth, and I don't think it's particularly close. You've got 250-pound men, and anywhere from 160 to 250, 260-pound men, skating on, or they're moving around on knife shoes. I mean, they're wearing shoes with knife blades on the bottom of them. Skating around really fast, hitting shots at over 100 miles an hour, hitting a piece of vulcanized rubber at other people, also just hitting other people with themselves. And a lot of the hitting they do is allowed, which is great and is not bad. And we're going to ignore the injuries that come from that. The NHL also has more parity than any other league, any other professional sports league. You can finish last one season, dead last one season, and conceivably end up in first or second place the next season. The NHL has a hard cap, whereas the NBA has like a luxury tax, like a luxury cap you can go over if you're willing to spend a ton of money. NHL doesn't have that. It's got a hard cap, and one player doesn't make all the difference in the world like it does in football, where your quarterback, you know, if you don't have a quarterback, you don't have a team, basically. And so it is the fastest, most physical team sport in the world. It is, in my opinion, the most exciting sport to watch live beyond a shadow of a doubt. And, you know, if you get attached to a team and they stink one year, just, you know, wait a year or two, unless you're in Buffalo. They're always bad.
Yeah. All right.
Poor Buffalo, man.
Yeah.
So hockey isn't just Canadian propaganda to get us to buy more maple syrup?
No, and if it was, they're doing a very bad job of it. A Canadian team hasn't won the Stanley Cup since 1993.
Wow, there you go. Facts for the conspiracy. 27 years.
That's right. The biggest hockey market in the world, Toronto, Canada, they haven't won a playoff series. The Maple Leafs, not Leaves, because why pronounce English correctly? The Maple Leafs have not won a playoff series since 2004. They have not won the Stanley Cup in 53 years.
Wow. Elrod's quick math really impressed me. I was like, how did he get 27 so quickly? And I remembered it was 2020. And then I was like a little bit less impressed, but still way quicker than I could have done. And I remember seeing it like on Twitter and stuff. And then you mentioned it earlier during the break. Speaking of the Toronto, and I heard you don't pronounce the T. If you're from Canada, you don't pronounce the T in Toronto. So the Toronto Maple Leafs.
Leafs.
Leafs. They got beat by a guy who was just like a normal guy, right? Like he was like, he like drove a Zamboni or like wasn't even like an NHL player and then played goalie for whoever they were playing and they lost.
Yeah, so the Toronto Maple Leafs, this would have been about a week and a half ago. So I guess February 22nd is the date. They were playing at home against the Carolina Hurricanes. The Carolina Hurricanes lost their starting goalie to injury on the first shot of the game. He saved it. They lost him on the first shot of the game.
Wow.
And then about halfway through the second period, so about halfway through the game, their backup goalie gets leveled by a Maple Leafs player. The goalie came out of the crease, that little blue paint area in front of the goal, came out of the crease to play a puck. A Toronto Maple Leafs player was trying to play the puck as well, and the Maple Leafs player just bowled him over. Well, in the NHL, in the regular season, you're only allowed to dress two goalies. You're only allowed to have your starting goalie and one on the bench. And so, you know, this situation happens every so often where both goalies get hurt. Probably happens about once every other year or so. And so the rule is the home team is required to have an emergency goalie ready to play for either team in the event that either team runs out of goalies.
Wow.
And so the Maple Leafs had a guy that works as a Zamboni driver for their minor league affiliate, dresses the emergency goalie. He's 42 years old. His name is David Ayers. He hadn't played professional hockey in any level in at least 5 years. I think he played in the AHL, the American Hockey League, the league right before the NHL, for a little bit, but hadn't played in the NHL ever, and hadn't played professional hockey or competitive hockey in any way, shape, or form in 5 years. And so he dressed, he got out there. He was actually wearing a Toronto Maple Leafs helmet out there playing goalie for the Canes. So they were up 3-1 when he got out there. The Canes went up 4-1 as soon as he got out there. They scored a goal. He let in the first two shots to make it 4-3. And then he saved, I think it was 8 in a row to close out the game. Carolina scored 2 more. And so they won 6-3. Wow. Now, the way the winning goaltender is determined in hockey is whoever is in net when what eventually is the game-winning goal goes in gets the win. And because he was in there when the fourth goal went in, he becomes the goalie of record. He gets the win. He's the first emergency backup goalie ever to be credited with a win. And he's the oldest goalie at 42 years old to win his NHL debut.
Wow. That's pretty cool.
So
this
awesome.
This guy was probably a Toronto Maple Leafs fan.
Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, he works for the organization. It's, he's decked out there. They actually made him put like a shell over his pads when he came out for the third period because they were blue.
Wow.
I mean, and the funny thing is he actually took practice against a couple of Maple Leafs the next morning. Who came out for shooting practice because he practices with the team on occasion.
Hmm.
Wow. Dude, that's now my life dream and goal is just to become a backup goalie for the Nashville Predators.
Yeah. Well, after last night, they might could use you just as the starter. They lost last night 8-3 to the Oilers. It was tied 3-3 going into the third period, and then Pekka let in 5. Pekka Rinne let in 5 in a span of 5 minutes and 17 seconds.
Wow.
And so they got to get up and play again tonight. They're in Minnesota tonight after laying possibly their biggest egg of the season last night.
Mm. Yikes. And they just went through a coaching change, correct?
They did. They went through a coaching change. I guess it's been a couple of months now, month and a half. After last night, they're 13-10-1 since they made a coaching change, which you look at that and you go above 500, that's great, but that might not be enough to get them in the playoffs. They're currently sitting in the last playoff spot in the Western Conference right now. And if they lose tonight, I think if they lose in regulation tonight, Minnesota might actually pass them among other teams who could pass them. There's like 4 or 5 teams that are gunning for that last spot right now.
And see, I've never actually really gotten into hockey, but some of my friends in high school really kind of started to get into it. And that was about the time the Predators went to the Stanley Cup. Maybe it was my first year or two in college. I'm not sure exactly when that was. But, I was like, okay, cool. The Predators are going to be good. That'll be neat to see them grow. I'll probably get into it. And then, the very next year, it was like, they weren't good anymore. And I see what you're saying about the flexibility and how one team can go from being great to bad and a bad team can go to being great.
Well, that year, so 2017, spring of 2017 is when they went to the final. And that year was actually a lot like this year. They were, they're the last team in. They actually had they were the 16th best team in the league. They were the worst team in either conference to make the playoffs. And they played, Chicago, who was the best team in the West, and not only did they beat them in the first round, they swept them. Chicago had two home games. They only scored one goal between those two games.
Wow.
Pekka Rinne actually had as many assists in Chicago as all of Chicago's roster, the goalie. And so, I mean, that fueled a run, which the Preds have been really popular in Nashville for about the past 8 years or so, 8 or 9 years. About 10 years ago, we were going to lose a team. I live in Oklahoma. What do I know? But we thought we were going to lose a team, that someone was going to come in, buy the team, and move it. And that did not happen. There was a commitment to stay. And all of a sudden, they got really good. They started making the playoffs. They started winning playoff rounds. 2017 was the first time they won two playoff rounds. And then they ended up winning three and going to the final and coming within two games of the Stanley Cup itself. And then since then, you know, they've been okay. They've made the playoffs each of the past 2 years since then, but
yeah,
they've only got one series win to show for it. And, you know, it's, you know, like I said, there's a lot of parity, and it's hopefully it's not swinging back that other direction, but it might be. You know, they may have to sell off some pieces that have been underperforming for them, and maybe rebuild the team around two or three guys that act like they actually want to be there.
Right.
See, that's kind of why I'm surprised you're not a bigger hockey fan, Elrod, because you got the whole like Nashville thing going on. Don't live too far from there, all that stuff. But I kind of have a theory about, and I mean, I'm not like a social scientist or anything, but I feel like we like the sports that like our family likes, if that makes sense. You know what I mean? Like, is like, so like Chris, is your like dad like a hockey fan and yeah, like your family?
We're both huge hockey fans. Y'all had Jeff on last week, my brother-in-law. He, we basically indoctrinated him into this. But we're all huge hockey fans. There's some of that, you know, where I root for a lot of the teams my dad, rooted for when I was growing up. I'm a big Braves fan. I'm a big Titans fan. I'm a big Preds fan. Really the only fandom I didn't get from him is I'm a Thunder fan, and he couldn't care less about the NBA. but the other part of that is when a team comes to the city, for the first time, the fan base will either latch on and, you know, all of a sudden it becomes one of the most diehard fan bases in the area or in the league, or it just doesn't stick at all and they're gone within a decade or 15 years. So like in Nashville, there are probably still more, Titans fans in Nashville than there are, Predators fans, but there are probably more diehard Predators fans in Nashville than there are Titans fans. That's the nature of the sport. And it's the fact that the Preds are, you know, consistently a big draw, whereas the Titans are, you know, they've been outside of this one, hopefully not fluky run, to the conference final this past year. They've been fairly mediocre for about 10 years now.
Yeah.
You know, they've been fairly mediocre for a while. Out here, the Thunder are huge. I mean, when it's not OU football season out here, the Thunder are the only thing in town that matters. and, you know, it helps that it's got this very community-oriented fan base. And it also helps that when you get your franchise for the first time, that they come built in with Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook for the first, what, 7 years of its existence, 8 years of its existence. Like,
yeah, and I actually had a question about that real quick. We don't talk a lot of basketball on this show, but Chris, now that you follow, I mean, obviously you follow basketball and stuff, you guys also had James Harden. And now that the whole, like, because, like, the last couple of days, like, people have been talking about, and a lot, you know, most people hate on the Rockets, but some people, and I think it's accurate personally, they're almost like changing the game in a way with the changes they've made, you know, getting rid of Capella and just going to like the super small ball. Russell Westbrook's playing center pretty much. Like, the fact that they're able to work that out in Harden and Westbrook, which everybody laughed at going into the season, is working actually like really good, at least the last couple games. Does that make you, and then of course KD's a phenomenal superstar, but I mean more recently, like, do you wish you guys would have kept Westbrook and maybe even Harden originally, or like it is what it is?
Well, I would have liked to have kept all three when it happened, but one of the things that doesn't get talked about is Harden didn't want to be here. Like, it's not that they didn't offer him a contract. They did.
Right.
But he didn't want to be, you know, this sixth man, which, okay, you know, do what you want to do. And so they traded him on the eve of, I forget the season, on the eve of the 2013-2014 season? They traded him to Houston for a haul that eventually included the pick that became Steven Adams.
There you go.
And so, you know, that trade wasn't just a complete bust for Oklahoma City. But given that one of those pieces moved, and given that KD left even, like, I don't want to say that you know, I was glad to see Russell Westbrook go.
Yeah.
Like he is, I mean, he is the king of Oklahoma as far as athletics are concerned. That guy probably won't ever have to pay for a meal anywhere in the state again in his life. He's got that level of respect because he's the guy that stayed. He's the guy that signed the extension.
Right.
But given that he left, you know, one of the things, if you've been able to watch the Thunder this year, they have completely changed how they play. The entire time, every year they were here up until this year, they were this very ISO-based basketball team. They did not run a full-blown team offense.
Right.
You knew what was coming at you nearly every single play. The only reason it worked is, you know, good luck stopping Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook. But now, you know, you've got Steven Adams surrounded by four shooters on any given night. You've got an old school playmaker in Chris Paul and, you know, his understudy in Shai Gilgeous-Alexander coming in and both playing very well. And it's totally different than anything that they've done in years past. Billy Donovan might win Coach of the Year just because the Thunder's record is basically the exact same as it was last year, and they are doing it with two fewer all NBA players. So,
wow, that is pretty impressive. Another question, and we'll start. Elrod, I want you to answer this, and then I want Chris to give his 2 cents too, since you guys are both Tennessee Titans fans. What, in your opinion, is the best move quarterback wise? And if you have to figure out, like, because I know kind of Derrick Henry, just with the money situation, might be involved in this somehow, but like really the quarterback situation, like dream scenario for the next season, who's playing quarterback, how does it happen?
Sorry for the dramatic pause. I needed to think. I don't know. I really just don't know. I think I don't know. I almost just want to say Marcus Mariota just because I know that's not true and that's not the best option at all. But like
not Kerry Collins.
Hey, Kerry Collins, man, that was my dude back in the day. I had his jersey. Only quarterback I've ever had a jersey for. Yeah, I don't know. I think I want to say Ryan Tannehill, but I really want to just say this. The best available quarterback. And whoever that is, in reality, is who I want. You know, I don't know who that is, though, because it could be Tom Brady. But I also feel like it could not be Tom Brady, you know? Right. So I feel like it could be Ryan Tannehill, but I also feel like it could not be Ryan Tannehill.
Right.
So I don't know. I'm interested to hear what Chris has to say.
Well, I think it's Tannehill. It was such a good fit, him in this offense. He did everything that was asked of him. You know, he took risks, which is something that Mariota never did. He was more responsible, though, than I think people expected him to be. I think Tannehill, with the caveat that they can't get locked into him for more than 2 or 3 years. Like, you can't sign that guy to a gigantic extension. You know, if he's making more money per year on like a 4-year deal than Tony Romo is going to make this year with CBS, then I'm going to have a problem with that. But if he gets like a 2-year, $30 million deal, I wouldn't hate that. I wouldn't hate that at all. I think none of it matters though, unless they re-sign Derrick Henry. I think he's that important.
Yeah.
And I agree with that. Like, he is the guy, like he is the face of our franchise, you know? And I think that if you bring Tom Brady to Nashville, then Derrick Henry and Tom Brady on the same offense are like at conflict, I feel like.
Well, Henry's not really a pass catching back.
Exactly.
We'll see what happens with Deion Lewis, but You know, that offense revolves around Derrick Henry. And yeah. Maybe that's not the wisest thing to have your offense revolve around a player, not the player himself, but a position as fragile as running back. But yeah. That's how it is. And that won't change next year, probably even the year after. So,
and but he has to get 30 touches a game too, roughly. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, and if he doesn't get that many touches, it's going to be hard for him to succeed. And it's going to be hard to bring Tom Brady in and have him hand off the ball 30 times, in my opinion. You know, like if you bring Tom Brady in, he needs to make 30 passes a game at least.
They're not running the Army offense, but they're running the same philosophy. You're going to have like, you know, seven possessions. You can score on us how you think you can in seven possessions. But, you know, there's no 2-minute offense with this Tennessee team. It's, you know, we're going to have a 10 play 8-minute drive or something like that. Like they're going to run the ball down your throat. They're going to tell you, if you can stop it, you can beat us, but you probably can't because, you know, we've got three all pros on our offensive line and we've got arguably, if not the best, then definitely the most important running back in the league. You know, I don't know if he's the most talented or not. I know that they ran that offense against New England and they ran that offense against Baltimore and they couldn't do anything about it.
Right.
So,
but you guys are on the same page. If it came down to either Tannehill or Henry, both of you guys want Henry.
Yeah.
Back. Yeah.
You know, and with Tannehill, part of that's just, you know, it's too small of a sample size. Like right. I really like him. I really like him as the quarterback of the team. But I don't want to sacrifice Henry to bring him back. And I don't want to, I don't want to give him such a large contract with term that we're locked into him. I do think the one thing that definitely won't happen is Mariota coming back. There's zero chance that guy's gonna that guy.
No,
is,
I agree.
That guy is destined to become, I don't know if he's going to go back up like Drew Brees or someone like that. But he'll be a backup for a good team. And he'll be a backup for a team that can pay him a little bit of money. You know, maybe he makes sense in Kansas City as their backup moving forward. You know, because Mahomes did get hurt and that offense kind of sputtered under Matt Moore. But that guy's not a starter in the league right now.
I just hope wherever he goes, they can use him even as the second string. Like they've got packages where they can plug him in and like do stuff with him. You know what I mean? Because I think he's talented enough to, if you've got a creative play caller, like maybe like an Andy Reid or somebody, he is talented enough to go out there and to do stuff, you know?
Or be a lead blocker for some running back. He's demonstrated he can do that.
That's true. He's also demonstrated he can throw the ball to himself. So, yeah, you know, maybe work that package in there.
Yeah, right. A play that does that.
Chiefs know firsthand all about that. So.
Right.
No, you're not the only person I've heard suggest Kansas City. I think we've talked about that before on the show. I know this is probably a long shot, but I kind of hope he's our backup. I don't know why, but I kind of do. I don't know. I think he just needs some time to rebuild some confidence, and I hope that wherever he goes, he can do that. You know, and if that means leaving Nashville, then adios. But I don't know.
I think you got to go somewhere where you think you can compete for the starting job. And granted, if he goes to Kansas City, he's not competing for the starting job, and so maybe that's a little self-defeating on my part. But you got to go somewhere where you've got a chance, because in Tennessee, maybe more than anywhere else in the league right now, he's not the starter.
That's true.
You know, he's got zero reason to think that Vrabel or anyone else in that organization could possibly envision him as the starter.
That's true.
You know, maybe it makes sense for him to go to Kansas City. Dallas might make a lot of sense. Guys where there are obvious holes behind them. Guys that have maybe, you know, there may be some situations where it's not clear what's going to happen. Carolina is a situation like that, because that's not a bad football team they have in Carolina. But, you know, they're also not firmly established in who their starting quarterback is going to be. I think as we're talking right now, it's not clear what's going to happen to Cam Newton.
And I think that's a good point, though. Like, I think if he went somewhere like Carolina or maybe even the Bucks, where, you know, they're going to possibly have a new quarterback, but they might be able to get a backup who's almost good enough to be a starter in Marcus Mariota and allow him to kind of push the other guy to be better, or for the other guy to push him to be better. And that you almost have the opportunity to get like a 2-for-1 deal,
right?
Which is kind of neat. That and then if you draft cool. someone, you have a 3-for-1 deal almost, yeah. You know, like,
well,
I don't know.
Well, and he makes a ton of sense as a backup because he doesn't turn the ball over. You know, he doesn't throw many picks. He's not going to lose many games for you. His problem in Tennessee was, generally speaking, he wasn't winning many games for you either. You know, I think one year he had, was it the year they beat Kansas City in the playoffs, or was it the year after, which would have been, I guess, last year, 2018, where they had, where he had 13 touchdowns and 15 picks, which 15 picks.
That was.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. That was the year they went to the playoffs, I believe.
Yeah. So 15 picks isn't a ton. That's not awful. You know, that's half of what Jameis Winston threw this year.
The problem was 13 touchdowns.
13 touchdowns because he's not taking the type of risks needed, and you can tolerate a few more picks. Now I'm not going to go full blown Jameis Winston argument. Ignore my picks. Look at all my touchdowns. You know, look at me balling out.
Come on, man.
But
he's a gunslinger.
Yeah, and he's a gunslinger who might not have a job in a few months here. But with Mariota, he's not losing games for you. He can protect the ball. He can dink and dunk.
Right.
You know, and part of the problem in Tennessee was the receiving core was not good enough to bail him out. There's no guy that you could throw to an open space. You know, throw maybe a 7-yard route to an open space and have them turn that into a 30-yard gain or something. There's none of that happening in Tennessee almost his entire tenure there. You know, A.J. Brown was a revelation this past season. But, you know, it's telling that that guy was the revelation when they haven't had even that guy for the past maybe their entire history, at least since Derek Mason.
I would say Kenny Britt was maybe the next. It was like the closest thing to a great wide receiver that we had.
Yeah, and then he turned into a head case.
Right. No, you're right. Yeah, he did. His last good play, he like tore his ACL or something, but like he went to like make a cut and just got in so much pain, he literally just threw the ball down and fell to the ground.
Oh, my.
And it was a fumble. And like that's like the last play I ever remember him making for us.
Alan, he, you know, that's. I mean, that's been their problem. That's been not the problem, but that's been their problem they've had in the organization since it's been in Tennessee. They've not had a true number one wide receiver. They've had a few guys that have looked the part for maybe a season at a time, and they've certainly had their fair share of great tight ends. You know, right. Wycheck was great. Delaney Walker was great until I kind of wonder if Delaney Walker might not just retire after this season because he's.
I hope he retires.
Yeah, I think who is it? Jonnu Smith is sort of settled into that role. You know, and so they've not been hurting for reliable pass catchers. They've just never had the guy, you know, the number one wideout that opposing defenses really fear. You know, and that's. You know, a guy like Mariota may benefit from having just that sort of guy to throw the ball to. So,
for sure. And, that's a good point.
And a steady coach. Like, if you could go somewhere with, like, an established coach with an established OC that can coach him. You know what I mean? And, like, him. Because the system did change several times in his.
Yeah, that's
defense,
true.
Yeah. You know? Like,
3 or 4 systems his 5 years there.
Yeah, I think it was 4 in 5 years. Yeah.
That's tough.
Yeah. It's but at the same time, it's the NFL and there's not a lot of those situations because, you know, a quarter of the league's coaches get fired every year.
Like, yeah, that's true.
And then if you're a good offensive coordinator, you get hired as a head coach somewhere.
Yeah, and then you get fired 2 years later because you weren't able to do the job of being a head coach. Like you're asking for Mariota in that particular case to be in like Kansas City. Or New Orleans.
Yeah.
Maybe no. Stefanski just left Minnesota. I don't think there's a situation he can go to with an established coach and OC where he also has a chance of being the starter. So
yeah, but maybe he can go somewhere where the coach establishes himself as the coach. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
It would be nice if that worked out. Like, because Vrabel at this point, I feel like, has established himself as the Titans coach moving forward. You know?
Well, and New Orleans. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, in Ryan Tannehill, if he comes back, there's a good chance that he establishes himself as the quarterback.
Right.
You know? And they can move forward together. And I would like to see, as a fan of Mariota, for him to have a similar situation where he can go and him and a coach can succeed together.
Yep. That's I just would like that to happen in the NFC if it's going to happen. So,
yeah, right. Maybe Cincinnati. I don't know what they're doing up there, but they got a new coach. They're getting rid of Andy Dalton. Maybe
I don't know that they know what they're doing up there.
That's true.
They're
drafting. Once you start putting chili on spaghetti noodles, everything else is meaningless.
Did you so they're drafting Joe Burrow. Did you see what he tweeted out the other day?
No.
So someone made the comment, maybe at the combine, about his hands being too small, and he said, I forget what the exact tweet was, but he said, I just learned today that my hands are too small to play in the NFL. I'm considering retirement at this time. Please respect my privacy.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that guy.
I hate how people just like nitpick people in the combine. Like, it gets to a point where it's almost like, this guy just blew up the SEC last season, and now his hands are too small. Come on.
Well, who's the wide receiver that did he break the combine record, or he came in top 10 combine all time for the 40 time this year?
Yeah, he was top 10. It's like Riggs or something like that.
Oh, Henry, one of the guys from Alabama, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So they showed the list of guys that had those records, and like Darius Hayward Bay was on there, and mm-hmm. Tyrone Calico was on there, and a few other guys. And it became very clear that that's not a list you actually want to be on.
Right.
I think the guy Cincinnati, John Ross III, was like second on that list. It's like, none of these guys have done anything in the league.
Right.
Like, Calico might be the most accomplished of all of them, and he didn't hardly do anything.
Right. So. Yeah, it's funny, like, these stats get so prioritized, and then when you look at the results, it's like, maybe it's not that important.
There's a few stats that matter. There's a few stats that legitimately matter, but, you know, running in your underwear in the 40 isn't necessarily one of them.
So. Right. How fast are you with pads on? That's what we want to see.
Now, granted, if you post Maurice Clarett's time, where he was like a high 5 point something when he ran the combine, if you're a running back and you're running slower than offensive linemen out there, that's a little jarring. I'm a little worried at that point.
That might be a problem.
But, you know, being ever so slightly faster than someone else in your underwear is not a football skill. That's not a football trait.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's... I don't know. I don't pay a lick of attention to the combine except what comes across my Twitter feed.
Right. So right.
There's hockey on. There's better things to do. So.
Makes sense.
Yeah. So I will watch the draft though.
Oh yeah, got to.
We'll do that. Let me rephrase that. That happens during the NHL playoffs, so I'll have that on my second screen.
So there you go. Yeah.
Oh man, we are a blessed nation for sure.
Yeah. Amen. Yeah. First world problems. Which do I pick? I don't have to pick either. So.
I guess I will conclude our sports section of Faith Football Friends. We're so grateful that Chris Kidwell was able to come on and be a part of our podcast today. We hope that you all enjoyed listening to the insights that he was able to provide about Old Testament ethics in his book review that he was doing, and his insights on hockey and sports in general. Had a lot more variety on the show thanks to him, and so we're thankful for that. So again, we hope that you'll like our podcast on Facebook and that you'll share it and give us a positive review. And we'd love to hear from our listeners, so we ask that you'll send us any feedback to our email, faithfootballfriends@gmail.com. And we'd love to hear from you. So we hope that you have a great day and that you'll continue to listen.